The weather has been weird. I think we can all agree on that. And weather reports are suddenly filled with names for storms and other weather phenomena that sound like they come straight from sci-fi.
New this morning, hundreds of people in the Pacific Northwest took advantage of the snowmageddon there with a major snowball fight.
Stretching from the Great Lakes all the way to the Gulf Coast, said our bomb cyclone not looking as impressive.
More than 40 people were transported to local hospitals as the polar vortex wreaks havoc across much of the country.
Snowmageddon, polar vortex, now bomb cyclones. What's the deal? I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to separate the hype in these words from the reality of our weather on KCUR's Central Standard. My guest is Al Patrika. He's a science and operations officer for the National Weather Service based out of Pleasant Hill. Hi, Al.
Good morning.
So can you explain what your job is, like what you actually do?
Yeah, I'm in charge of, I'm a manager at the office, and with training the staff, the forecasters, with as new technology comes online and as the science, atmospheric science evolves, I train the staff to keep them at top of their game.
I hear that you also keep a weather glossary handy, just for your reference.
Yeah, there's a glossary from the American Meteorological Society, and it's a finely print hardback.
How big is it?
Oh, it's about, over 800 pages.
Whoa.
With just full of terms that are sanctioned that we reference to keep everybody on the same page.
Are these the terms that you're hearing more of in the news these days?
Well, we're definitely, as was just played, hearing some terms come up that maybe a lot of people haven't heard before.
Are they terms? So, like, between your meteorology expertise and your trusty glossary, you are someone who really would know whether the words getting thrown around on the news are describing real phenomena in a legit kind of way, or if they're sensationalizing pretty typical situations we have seen before for clicks or ratings or whatever.
Sure. Yes.
What do you think?
I've seen both. I'm hearing both, seeing both, yes.
So, why do you think we are suddenly hearing so many terms that we've never heard before? Is it because the weather itself is changing, or is it because weather coverage is changing?
It may be. I would say probably the coverage more than anything else, and in a way to mix it up, get people's attention, I think, more than anything else.
I'd like to give you a little quiz. We're calling it hype versus real.
Okay.
And each of the terms I'm going to throw out, I want you to tell me whether you think it's more of a hype thing or a real thing. And I do realize that a lot of them are probably some combination of the two. Don't worry. We will back up after the quiz and dig in deeper, okay?
Sure.
Just if you had to pick one.
Right.
All right. Polar vortex, hype or real?
Real.
Bomb cyclone, or as the U.S. Army Corps uses, bombogenesis.
Very real.
Snowmageddon and its variants, such as snowmg and snowpocalypse.
Very much hype.
Cyclone and its nemesis, anticyclone.
Yeah, very real.
Golf ball-sized hail, popular variant, hail no.
Golf ball, yes. The variant, no.
Gustnado.
That is real.
What about fire-nado?
That's slang for fire whirl, but very real.
Let's go back and explain what a couple of these terms
sure.
are actually attempting to describe, starting with the gustnado and fire-nado.
Let's do gustnado first. Basically, all it is, it's a circulation that can develop on the leading edge of winds produced from a thunderstorm, and they can look like a tornado at times, and if you have umbrellas out or a trampoline and get hit, it'll toss it, but usually they're pretty benign.
What about the fire-nado? You were just saying that is real.
Yes.
But that it is typically called a fire whirl?
Well, the fire whirl would be the slang. Fire whirl, is the proper term. But what this is, it's a vertically oriented vortex that's produced from the intense heat, and it's a column of ascending air lifting smoke, debris, and fire. They can be very dangerous. They range in size from less than a foot to over 500 feet in diameter, and they belong in the same family as like a dust devil. But what makes these dangerous to not only the firefighters, but they can aid in spreading the hot embers further away from the parent fire and starting spot fires downstream. So they're a problem out west with wildfires.
When you are they a bigger problem than they used to be, or are we just hearing more about weather than we used to.
I think we're just hearing more than we're used to because everybody has a cell phone these days and can take a picture. We can get on social media. So there's greater awareness.
So the detail we're hearing about weather, especially in places we don't live, is new.
Yeah, you could say that.
Okay. Yeah. What about – can you talk to me more about the bomb cyclone? Because that to me is the most recent, like, bomb cyclone? This is weather?
Sure. The term actually has been around for a long, long time. Originated back in Europe in the late 40s, early 50s. All it is it's a description of how we measure the intensity of a storm system. They typically occur in the maritime regions around the globe, but can occur, as has happened here recently, in the central part of the U.S. But it's just a way of describing how rapid the central pressure drops in the system. And there's a definition for it of like 18 millibars for our neck of the woods in 24 hours, which is a lot of deepening for a storm. And it's just a fancy way of saying this is going to be an impressive storm.
Why don't people just say this is going to be an impressive storm?
Good question.
It wouldn't make me be like, wait, what are you talking about?
Well, you know, you hear the word bomb and it gets your attention, doesn't it?
It sure does, but it makes me feel like
something scary.
Like, it also makes me question like whether I'm really listening to news. You know what I mean?
Sure. You know, I can't answer why they're using the term lately as much as they have, but it certainly has drawn a lot of attention. And if it creates awareness, you know, for people to pay attention to the weather, where they respond properly to stock up on supplies or whatever they need to do to keep safe, no harm there.
What about polar vortex? Can you explain a little bit about what that was? We had that super weird couple of days where we went from like 8, it got up into the 80s, and then it dipped down into another freeze.
Yes. Polar vortex, it's an area of low pressure that exists over the poles, both the North Pole and the South Pole. But for our neck of the woods, we'll talk about the North Pole. And basically, it's a wide expanse of swirling cold air that resides over the North Pole. And then at times, it can weaken and wobble and brings down lobes of cold air in the winter months, where we'll see extended periods of very, very cold, maybe accompanied with storms, things like that.
So it's like some of the polar air kind of like got out.
Sloshes down into our neck of the woods. That's right.
It seems funny to me that air belongs to a place.
It's where the air, yeah, to get cold air, you need the point origin, the source. So where is it going to be cold? The coldest is going to be at the poles, right? And the warmest is going to be at the equator. And that's where this time of the year, as we're heading into the warm season, that's where we get our warm air from, is coming up from the south, from the down by the equator.
Why does cold air suddenly come in? Do we have the answer to like why, or does weather not work that way?
Well, we know why cold air it does come down here. Colder air is denser, if you will, than warmer air, so it can undercut and mix out that warmer air. And in the winter time, low sun angle, things like that, it's hard to warm it back up. So it's easy for air from way up north in Canada and the poles to make it down here.
You were very decisive that Snowmageddon, SnowMG, and Snowpocalypse were pure hype.
Not in my glossary.
Well, then we will just skip right over those and talk about the cyclone and anti-cyclone, which I'm waiting for the superhero movie on their rivalry.
I know, it's like Star Wars, right? Yeah. Cyclone, it's a fancy way of saying an area low pressure or a storm system. It's just another term. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, it's the winds turn in the clockwise direction. And if you hear cyclone, just associate it with the potential for stormy or unsettled weather. Conversely, anticyclone, that's fancy speak for high pressure. And when we have high pressure, generally we have nice, warm, or cloud-free days and no bad weather.
I feel confident that hail is real because I have seen it with my own two eyes and people have talked about it for as long as I'm aware. Like, I mean, I think there are references to it going back to like ancient texts. But what is it?
Hail?
Yeah, because it is so weird.
It's ice, right? Ice that's produced in thunderstorms. Really, that's all it is. Now, there's a lot of science behind
I'm
how
making
hail
a
forms.
Face at you.
I can see that. Basically, it's water droplets that have frozen. And they get recycled in strong updrafts and thunderstorms. and they can keep doing that and get bigger and bigger until they reach a size where the air rushing up can't support it and gravity takes over and it falls down.
But how can there be ice when it's not freezing out?
Down here at the surface, it's not freezing out. But once you get above us several tens of miles, it's very, very cold aloft. In fact, in thunderstorms, the precipitation starts out actually as snowflakes. And then as it falls, it gets warmer, warmer, and melts into liquid. And then if we can mix that up in an updraft, and it can collect more and more water on it, and that particle grows, and it refreezes and refreezes and refreezes, and so, say, golf ball size, and that the air can't support it anymore, down it comes.
That's pretty weird.
I know.
Are there weather words that maybe we should be hearing right now but are not because they're not sexy or are just harder to understand? I won't make you speculate on why, but like weather words that we haven't heard a lot and yet maybe should.
Now that we're coming into summer, you'll be hearing a lot about dew point.
Dew point. D-E-W, I'm guessing.
D-E-W, point. And it's a way we measure how much moisture is in the air. And in short, it's if we could cool the air down to a point, you can get condensation or dew on the grass like you see in a nice morning, things like that. The warmer that temperature is this time of the year, the muggier it is, the more humid it is. That's why it's like, why is this important to me? Why do I care about this thing called dew point?
Yeah, why do I?
Well, because those days when it's a lot of moisture in the air, you feel it come June, July, August, and your hair gets frizzy and it's sticky outside and you don't want to be out there.
Yeah, so if I am, how would I find out what the dew point is if I wanted to be forewarned about my hair's frizziness?
Well, you could listen to the local news or go to our website for the forecast. We'll have it on there.
So as you're scanning about the temperature and likelihood of precipitation, maybe take a quick peek at dew point.
Dew point. And, okay, where would you want to know where it's a concern? When you hear dew point temperatures in the summertime, say in the 60s, 70s, or even the extreme of low 80s, that's a miserable day.
You know, we name everything now. It used to be just hurricanes. What is going on with that? Why are we naming like winter storms and perhaps looking ahead? I mean, I don't know what's going to get named as the summer comes upon us.
We, the National Weather Service, we don't name storms. That's done by the private sector. So that's where that has come to light in the last few years. What we do, the Weather Service definitely does name hurricanes. That we've done for many, many years, and we'll continue to do so. So
why?
Why the hurricanes? Mm-hmm. It's just from back in the day, that's where they started naming storms to associate historically, say a Katrina or a Floyd or something like that, a Hugo.
In a really destructive storm, you've just like taken an actual name out of circulation, basically.
Yes. If it's a bad storm based on a lot of criteria, they'll retire that name so you never hear that name come up again.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, weird theory here, but it seems to me that isolated weather events feel random to people in general. Like when there's like a tornado and it hits one block and not another, mm-hmm. and then it's just gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels on the ground like it's come from nowhere and it just destroyed something.
Sure.
With no good reason. In storytelling, there's this rule, no deus ex machina, which means no god outside the machine, which basically means if you're writing a novel, you cannot just find a character kind of like, I don't know what to do with this character. I'm going to make them get struck down by lightning or something mm-hmm. and never speak of them again. There has to be a rhyme or reason for what happens that comes from within the established world of the story. And I feel like weather is 100% deus ex machina. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that when we name storms and give these sensational names to weather phenomena, that in a way we are trying to like take narrative control of the weather?
You know, that's a fascinating thought. I don't disagree with you on that. I can see that. Yeah. Yeah.
In real life, as spring and summer 2019 are on our horizon, what will you be looking at? What questions are you going to be asking as an actual weather person who deals in science and not ratings?
Well, we're going to be looking at going into the season, what we're expecting as far as how bad the season potentially could be for here. more so on the backside of we go back and what happened, why did it happen the way it did, or something evolved the way it did. Why was that tornado randomly just right there and then gone? To go back to your example, things like that. So that's that type of stuff keeps us very busy.
Al Patrica, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Al's a science and operations officer for the National Weather Service. He's based in Pleasant Hill. Up next, our city's culinary DNA. Do you have a theory about what defines it? Send us a tweet at KCURCST. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here with Jenny Vergara of Feast Magazine. She's just written the definitive essay on Kansas City's food culture for Google. They created an arts and culture page for Kansas City, which is kind of a new thing, and Jenny was tapped to say what's up with food here for all of the internets to read. That is quite an undertaking, and I've actually wondered since Jenny's article came out what I would say about the food here in one essay if someone asked me. I don't think I could do it. Jenny did, and she's here to talk about it. Hi, Jenny.
Good morning.
Your essay is titled Smoke Rings and Finer Things. What does that mean?
Yeah, so Google actually asked me to kind of spitball some titles for this. That is the title, actually, of the overall pod that they put together about arts and culture. And it was really about talking about barbecue all the way up to the beautiful museums, the finer food we have. So it was trying to kind of cover the spectrum with smoke rings and finer things. But my article itself was called Kansas City's Culinary DNA, which I thought was kind of an appropriate name to give this article that kind of covers supposedly the food scene. And it was daunting. I mean, I'll be honest.
Yeah, like, because as a food journalist, your usual thing is to be like, here's like this person and what they're doing. Here's this place and what they're doing. Here's a specific trend. All of those things do come together to create a complete picture. But to step back from it and say, here's what that story is. That's huge.
Well, and to me, it was even more pressure than that, the pressure that I put on myself with regards to this. First of all, the good news was I only had 5 days to do it, about 5 to 7 days.
Oh, my God.
So the timeline was really, really short, which meant I couldn't futz around too much and think too hard about it, which in some cases is really good for me, at least in my writing style. But, you know, it was daunting because we have had so many writers come from all over, bigger cities, come to Kansas City from major newspapers like the New York Times and Vogue and, you know, Travel and Leisure. And they come to our city as tourists and they leave going, what do you know? Kansas City has great food. Who knew that? You know, and for those of us,
you can't write that piece.
Oh, my gosh. For those of us who live here, we're like, catch up. You know we have good food. And so that was really the pressure that I put on myself was, okay, I have been frustrated with many, many food articles written about Kansas City that seem to just focus on barbecue and not much else.
Or to be reacting to a dated stereotype that perhaps no one even believes anymore.
Right.
So like, it's like refuting an argument no one's really making.
Well, it's, you know, it's kind of one of those things where I get it. Barbecue is, I mean, and to take nothing away from barbecue, it certainly is. And my piece kind of spells that out. It's the core of our food scene. It is the thing that we talk about when we say our food is our barbecue, as it should be. I mean, we have and own a regional style of barbecue with Kansas City's name on it.
And it is time consuming and requires great skill. It's, yeah.
Right. All of that. I mean, all the things that you think about food go into barbecue. And so that at its heart absolutely is where we should start. How I knew kind of where to start my piece was I actually sat down with Andrea Broomfield's Kansas City food biography book. And kind
we
of
love that book.
Oh, my gosh. I am obsessed with that book. And I refer to it again and again when I need kind of inspiration. And so I quickly kind of flipped back through that book and realized that her journey started kind of prehistoric Kansas City, you know, what the prairies were like, what kind of flora and fauna were here, and ended right at barbecue, basically. And when I finished, I was like, oh, that's it. That's what I need to do. I need to take it from barbecue to today. I mean, that's really the goal. So that felt a lot less daunting that I didn't have to go back and explain like the history of Kansas City and all the immigrants that came here and put all their, you know, brought all their food and put their stamp on our food scene. I could actually start at this place and go to here. And the James Beard Awards had just come out, so I thought a natural place would be to go, you know, from barbecue to beard, from, you know, to James Beard. And that was really kind of how I framed the article.
One of the moments in the article that really was interesting to me was the sort of earliest times when Kansas City did get acknowledged in James Beard Awards. I hadn't really, it's become such an annual thing that mm-hmm. someone here is up for something.
Right.
But that was not always the case.
Right, right. In fact, it was funny because I turned in the first draft of this and Google pushed back and said, so what happened before Stroud's got their, you know, Kansas City got their first James Beard Award with Stroud's winning, you know, kind of America's favorite comfort food spot or iconic comfort food spot. And I had to stop and think, and I thought, who knows, right? How is it documented? I would tell you it's, you know, it was probably still barbecue and comfort food at that point. A lot of, you know, a lot of fried chicken and a lot of barbecue. You know, nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I said, well, you know, from a national perspective, we probably didn't start to kind of come on the radar until you have people with a national microphone or a national scope able to come and cover the city. We don't get that kind of press.
And so the moment that we first get a James Beard Award is for comfort food. And it is for, and again, nothing wrong with fried chicken.
Right.
But it is for something people might associate with not one of the big cosmopolitan food mm-hmm. centers of the world. Mm-hmm. And that does change too.
Right, exactly. So, you know, the very next year after Kansas City gets this, the award, Stroud's gets the award for kind of their most iconic comfort food place by the Beard Foundation, they come back and they give it to the American. They give it to Michael and Debbie, Michael Smith and Debbie Gold, who won joint James Beard Awards for cooking at the American. So within 1 year, you know, they gave us the comfort food award and then they came right back and went, oh, and here's, you know, the finest fine dining restaurant. The two chefs there get Best Chef Midwest. So
think about
that really
year
telling.
And that journey of is it a journey in terms of the food that exists here or is it a journey in terms of acknowledging the food that exists here?
You know, I think for Beard, it's more about you know, coming to a city and just recognizing what they're good at and what they should be recognized for. Obviously, the American has a long history with the James Beard Foundation. James Beard himself helped to write the first menu at the American.
Really?
Yes, yes. So there's a very long, long history between kind of the James Beard Foundation and the American. So it makes perfect sense that they would come here and go, you know what, let's give it to Stroud's for their comfort food. And, oh, hey, while we're in town eating Stroud's and checking this out, let's go have some other meals. And that's usually how you kind of start to gain awareness is as people are eating around your city while they're here. So I like to fantasize that maybe they came into town to try Stroud's to recommend them for this award and then probably had one beautiful night at the American and walked away thinking, we need to put these people on our radar. So this restaurant, these chefs.
What do you think when you compare what year are we talking about again?
So it was 1998 when Stroud's got it, and it was 1999 when Michael Smith and Debbie won theirs.
It's been 20 years since then.
Mm-hmm.
What is the journey of those 20 years in your mind? As you know, back then, I don't know if you were a Kansas Cityan yet then or not, but as a Kansas Cityan now, what mm-hmm. do you see that journey being?
So I moved to the city in 1991, so I was here for
you
that.
You were here.
I was. But the truth of the matter is that I think the journey is really about us becoming aware of what we have here in Kansas City is a bounty. I mean, we live less than an hour from most farms and ranches here in Kansas City. We have access to incredible ingredients, both produce and proteins, as do the restaurants. You know, and we pick them up at the farmer's market as well. We cook with them at home. So I think it was about the journey of recognizing the bounty we have in our backyard, being unafraid to say, this is what grows in Missouri. This is what grows in Kansas. These are the ingredients that make up our food scene. And now what are we going to do with them? How are we going to elevate them? Putting them into, you know, a French construct or putting them into a Mediterranean dish or adding whatever restaurant you were talking about, kind of special spin on it. And it was about taking comforting ingredients that we all had seen and grown up with and elevating them and figuring out how to kind of reimagine them, I think, within the finer dining construct. And that's pretty much where we are today. It's that interesting, the DNA kind of refers to both the casual side of our food as well as the fine dining preparations, from comfort food to cutting edge cuisine. That's kind of the window we're talking about.
Do you think that the James Beard Foundation taking note of Kansas City and doing that with a global audience also maybe gave chefs with high aspirations a sense of maybe permission to either stay here or come here to do what they do here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and we know that because you just have to look at the roster of fantastically talented chefs that cranked through the American during their years that they were operating, obviously, as a five-star restaurant. I mean, some of our best Kansas City talent has come out of that kitchen and gone on to other cities. Some have gone on to other cities. Some have stayed and opened up butcher shops. Some have stayed and opened up their own restaurants. Many of them have actually opened up their own restaurants. So,
can you name a few of those for people who don't kind of know this progression?
Sure.
It's like in the culinary world, there's this tradition, the stage. You know, you stage at someone's restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the American is the place where that happened for so many years.
Mm-hmm. In fact, there was a whole part of this article that I actually ended up editing out that talked about how chefs may come out of our JCCC, for example, culinary program. They may go into a fine dining restaurant. If you do want to do fine dining food, there were really two options to go in and start working at the time, and that was the American and then obviously Blue Stem when it opened. And both of those kitchens saw many, many chefs. Now, before that, Le Fou Frog saw an awful lot as well. The River Club has had a lot of chefs crank through there as well.
A private dining club, right?
That's right. A private dining club. That's correct. But, you know, there is this thing where chefs were encouraged in the, you know, back in the day to get their feet wet here and then figure out and go somewhere else. So go to Europe, go to a bigger city, go to a bigger market, not only for more opportunities, because there were only a handful of jobs here that people could have. And if you were getting to the point where you were kind of no longer able to be a sous, really looking for that next step of as executive chef, there weren't a lot of places to step into in that role in Kansas City. So you were encouraged to go to other markets, have those experiences. But ultimately, you know, Kansas City is extremely affordable and extremely friendly. And most of these chefs had family here. And so when they were ready to settle down and get married and start having their families, it made sense that they would come back here to be closer to family and open their restaurant in a market where they could afford to have a small footprint with, you know, 40 seats and try it on their own. So, you know, I do think that having James Beard recognize us on kind of a national scale and really almost an international scale at this point really has kind of said, you don't have to go anywhere else. We're going to come to you and recognize your food, which is a totally different dynamic. So I think that's changing.
When you mentioned the friendliness of Kansas City just mm-hmm. now, and that is actually a pretty significant component of what you've written as well. Mm-hmm. And you trace it back to the "Hi, may I help you" at Gates Barbecue.
Mm-hmm. I tried to think about, you know, I knew that I wanted to end with the hospitality scene in general, because that was the other piece. It was, tell us about the food and kind of the history of it that in terms of the goal of this article, and then tell us about the hospitality scene, which is a little bit different. Hospitality is about service and making people feel welcome. And I thought, well, we have that in spades. We're the friendliest, you know, over and over and over again. You hear it, you see it, you experience it yourself. We are a friendly town. We are friendly to strangers who come in from out of town, and we treat them well. And so I thought, how could I encapsulate that in just a simple, you know, kind of one or two sentences? And I thought, there's no better way to encapsulate that than the "Hi, may I help you?" I mean, it is the greeting that greets you at the front door. You know, before you even have a chance to even look at the menu, you're, you know, "Hi, may I help you?" So I thought that I would kind of pull that into the piece to kind of circle it back to barbecue, as well as try to explain that, you know, if Kansas City has been a flyover state, if we have been a place where people are coming on their way to somewhere else, or traveling somewhere else too. You know, the one thing that we know is that, you know, a good meal, a great drink, and a friendly smile is all people need to feel welcome. And that's, Kansas City can deliver that in spades.
When you think about the Kansas City friendliness and how it does fit into food and hospitality, what is your bigger takeaway there about what it means to eat here? Not just to make food here, but to eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is a kind of a whole nother thing, you know, to talk about is how does it make you feel to eat in a Kansas City restaurant? The thing is that whenever you're traveling somewhere else, you're already discombobulated. So many things have been disrupted. Your sleep site, you're not sleeping in your bed. You know, you've probably traveled some long hours. You've been on a jet or a car or whatever for many, many hours. Now you're in a strange place where you really don't know where you're going. You need an Uber to take you there, or you're trying to figure out with your GPS where you should be going. So there's so many things that kind of feel like hurdles to overcome when you're traveling, that going out to eat and having a friendly face and someone who's willing just to chat with you as they pour you another cup of coffee at breakfast can make a huge difference. And I think Kansas City inherently, I mean, part of it is the fact that we were just raised with good manners, I think, in the Midwest. You know, I mean, we are a friendly people to begin with. But Kansas City in particular, we embrace our friendly. We have never shied away from saying, no, we're not a friendly town. We are a friendly town. And we embody that in our hospitality. So I think what it feels like to eat out in Kansas City is easy and comforting. And, you know, I think the more that we've gotten away from kind of all the white tablecloth, fine dining fluffery, if you will, that has been around that, and just kind of, you know, make even the fine dining restaurants want you to, it's fine to come in jeans. They don't have white tablecloths anymore. You know, they've just got a nice linen napkin for you or whatever. So
yeah, we've got really nice restaurants with like gravel patios and picnic tables.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, and that's kind of part of it. It's about, you know, making you feel comfortable, not making you have to put on a fussy jacket to come and, you know, do much of anything in this town. And that's part of just being welcoming to everyone and just allowing everyone to come and experience the hospitality that we bring.
I was also thinking about the fact that it seems like even the high-end restaurants here, but that's is in common with like the diners and the barbecue joints, is that there are real regulars at Kansas City restaurants. There are communities around restaurants. And I am sure that that's true in other places as well, but it seems to really span the whole dining spectrum here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and I think that's absolutely true. I mean, especially like neighborhood spots. I was in Pot Pie 2 weekends ago and I was like, all of these people know everyone else in this dining room except for me, you know, because I haven't been a regular. It's probably been almost a year or more since I had been in Pot Pie. And it struck me, these people come every weekend. This is their spot to come. You know, and for some people, that regularity, that comfort of knowing that that food is going to be there, those people will be there to welcome me, you know, it's a Friday ritual or it's a Saturday ritual, or people do look forward to that kind of experience dining out.
When you think about that, Andrea Broomfield wrote this biography of food in Kansas City, and that it ends with the establishment of barbecue. That's where it culminates. Mm-hmm. And then you take the story and go from the establishment of barbecue and take it forward to today. Do you have a crystal ball into which you can look for me now and tell me what is the next chapter?
That is a good question. You know, I think all major cities right now are starting to embrace the idea that each of them have their own flavor, their own terroir, if you will, where, you know, the things that you grow, the things that you raise are the things that inherently you should be cooking with, that are going to taste the freshest, that will be seasonal. And, you know, I think that's one of those things where Kansas City, too, now has come to this point where we're recognizing what we do well here and emphasizing that. I think going forward, it's about being maybe more vegetarian and vegan focused. I think it'll be a trade-off between kind of our meat and our barbecue background and kind of looking ahead to more kind of vegetable and healthier options.
Make room for veggies.
Make room for veggies. Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Jenny Vergara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jenny's essay on Kansas City's culinary DNA is up on Google's Arts and Culture page for Kansas City. They've also got essays by locals on architecture, pop culture. Check it out, see what you think, and tweet us your commentary at KCURCST. I'm Gina Kaufman. More Central Standard is on the way. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to hear the story of a guy named Otto P. Higgins. He was a Kansas City Star reporter who brought news from World War I home to his readers in the form of 218 dispatches from the front lines. Otto was just 27 when he started writing these dispatches in 1918 and on into 1919, but his story is just now being told for the first time in a new book called Frontlines to Headlines, written by someone who knew him personally, our next guest, James Hyman. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
What is it that Otto P. Higgins and his wartime reports meant to Kansas City about a century ago? I mean, those of us living today have such a different kind of access to global events as they unfold. Can you help us understand this other time that kind of frames the story you're telling?
Well, you used the word global, and I think that's a well-chosen word. You know, I think the emphasis of this war was largely local. The troops that Otto knew, so many of them that he knew here in town, he met over there again, were trained at Camp Funston. The 89th Division was, those were the draftees, and the 35th Division, the National Guard, down at Fort Sill. So he had trained with them and reported on them before he went over. And when he got there, of course, he saw them again. So it was very much a local war. And as he wrote the reports, he makes a lot of references to places in Kansas City. So the emphasis, I think, is the locality of the war. And I think that's the biggest distinction between—
He was following our boys, basically.
Yes, absolutely.
A lot of newspapers did send accredited correspondents over to Europe during World War I, and those correspondents had a really solemn responsibility because people back home didn't necessarily know before these correspondents wrote to them what the reality of this war was. I mean, it turned out to be a new kind of war.
Absolutely. That's very true. And even Otto himself, as he was writing, you know, was aware of that and talked about it in some of the reports that he made.
What was new about it? Can you explain that?
Well, for one thing, the artillery was devastating, killed more people than anything except for the influenza, which killed even more. And the machine guns were completely devastating as well. And so a combination of those three changed the way that people fought the war. And, I mean, like on the Somme, for example, when the British went in and early in the war, they lost 10,000 people, you know, like on the first day. So they had not adapted to the war. And that's what the training and everything when we came in 1917.
But he's writing back to, you know, mothers and fathers, cousins, brothers, sisters of the people who are serving. That's who his audience is. What a weight to bear to tell them this is what's happening.
It is a great weight. And he was, as the war went on, of course, and the casualties mounted, he was very, very aware of that. See in the book that almost at the end of the chapters, as the war comes to an end and he begins to come back, there's a heavy emphasis on the graves, the boys who did not return.
What do we need to know about Otto as a person to understand how he saw things and what made his dispatches unique?
I think probably the most important thing about his character was that he was very, very sensitive to the cost of this war, the human cost of the war. And he, as a writer, he really wrote features and he really emphasized, you know, how much it cost the individual soldiers. So I think more than anything else, that would be part of his character, that kind of sensitivity that really communicated to people.
His clippings, which his wife Elizabeth saved, sat in a trunk, and the trunk was inside a vault, and the vault was inside a locked storage locker, which was in a basement of a house in Kansas City on Harrison Street. And all of that stayed locked up for a long, long time. It was not clear that this story was ever going to see light of day.
It's a very interesting comment, and it's kind of a metaphor for the war itself, you know. When these fellows came back from the war, the ones who did return to Kansas City, they brought with them the memories of the boys who didn't, and that was locked deep inside of them as well. And those boys were changed by this experience in a tremendous way, and so was Otto. And so I think it was very difficult, you know, for them to talk about the war to anyone who was not there, hence the number of American Legion posts in Kansas City. There were up to 15 of them after the war. And he himself, although he talked about the war and wrote about it a little bit afterwards, he didn't, with the encouragement of his wife, Elizabeth, who people knew as Higgy, she collected these articles and encouraged him to write about it, but he didn't. Now, he did encourage someone whom he had known on the Star, Emmett Crozier, to write about the war. Emmett had written a book about war correspondence during the Civil War. Otto wrote him a letter and said, you know, you should write about the guys in World War I. We're still around, most of us, and we won't be for very long. I'll help you do it. So that's how he contributed to it.
As I mentioned a moment ago when I introduced you, you knew Otto P. Higgins personally, and that has not come up yet, which surprises me a little. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your personal relationship with Otto P. Higgins?
Yes. From the time I was about 8 years old until I was 20, so those 12 years, that's when he died in 1965, I knew Otto personally, and for a little while anyway, I'd lived with him when I was attending school at Rockhurst. Would walk from the house over to school, so I knew him quite well.
Like a boarder, a renter in his house or something?
No, I was just a family friend.
Oh, okay.
Was there for, maybe it wasn't that long, maybe 3 or 4 months, and left about the middle of the year. But, I got to really to know him pretty personally quite well. Yeah.
What inspired you about him as a person? Because the decision to write a book about him, and this is a hefty book, and a book where you did a lot of research, and I understand it's even much shorter than your first draft. You did a lot of work to get this story out there, which I know is partly about the history of this war, Kansas City's relationship to it, what these correspondents did, the role they performed. But it has to also be about something he inspired.
Yes. When I was very young, maybe 10, 11 years old, he gave me his Sam Brown belt and some saddle soap. And he said, I'm going to give you this from the war. He said, now every Christmas, use the saddle soap and keep it alive, So that was kind of a metaphor, and he knew I was a coin collector, so he gave me a cigarette tin with coins from the war, 1917, 1918.
Different European bills. Currencies.
That's French and German mostly. So, there was a physical correspondence there that in memory. At no time did I even expect that I would write about that or tell his story. But it was something that stayed with me.
What changed your mind? What made you think, no, I will tell this story? This is what I'm going to do.
Well, probably that I was in the Vietnam War, and that made an impact on me, and especially when I came back home to a country that did not recognize us. And so there was an affinity there. And I was always interested in his writing. He was a great storyteller, and we had a love of books, that we shared.
I wonder, do you think that that your experience as someone who served in Vietnam would have been different if there had been an Otto P. Higgins going from Kansas City to Vietnam in that war?
Well, I wasn't actually in country, but I was in the service, and my experience did change my perspective. I'm not sure. I think I still would have written about it, even though I would not have gone through that. It's just a story that needed to be told, and it just kept staying with me. And what happened was that towards the end of my career in education, I stopped off at the Central Library in Kansas City on the way home. And I began to read his stories. I looked them up in the newspaper and found out they were on microfilm, and that just kept me going.
Let's talk about those stories.
Sure.
He started in a cemetery in Ireland, right?
Yes, Clonmel.
Tell me about the dispatches from there.
Well, that was the first article that I found in the Star. It came out in on May the 1st of 1918, and what it was is that he started at a cemetery there, and with the Lusitania, the victims of the Lusitania, and of course that was one of the factors really that got us into the war. It wasn't the only one, but I thought it was very significant. His father was from Ireland, his mother, his grandmother actually was German, spoke German. So there was an interesting combination there of the German and the Irish, and Otto spoke German. So I thought it was really significant that he begins in a cemetery. He also kind of ends on the same note. The last piece that he wrote was in 1919 about a woman named Madame Giraud, G-I-R-O-T, Giraud. And interestingly enough,
the war is over.
Yes, the war is over, and he's writing a series of articles that are under the title From the Notebook of OPH. And he's writing about this woman, and she died at the very same time in May of 1915. So he begins and ends with that particular month and year about the war, but it's the impact of people. You know, that's why I said earlier that—
To start in a cemetery is—
Right.
There is a symbolism in that, and there's also a real bravery in that.
Yes, I think
you can hardly be called a rah-rah war correspondent when you start your dispatches from a cemetery.
That's right. Absolutely right. Yeah, the sensitivity. And every month it seemed like I've divided up the articles and by month, and it seemed like that as the war ended and he began to talk to the boys as they were coming home, you know, he has more and more awareness, and he visits some of the cemeteries there where the boys are buried in France and Germany. Yes, and people he knew, many people he knew, and he was with a battle in the Meuse-Argonne especially. So, yeah, I mean, that awareness, he was anticipating what was going to happen. He knew it.
Can you tell me a little bit about the content of those cemetery dispatches?
Well, I read a phrase out of this first one. He says, three large plots were set aside for the victims of the Lusitania, and these contain most of the bodies. A few others are buried in private plots. It was almost 3 years to a day when I stepped from a quaint little Irish jaunting cart into the cemetery, and the tulips and forget-me-nots on the well-tended graves were in blossom. The wallflowers were just in bud, and the evergreens that surround the plots were as green as the grass underfoot. And then he goes on, he ends it with this sentence, only one grave, a private one, contains an epitaph that clearly and concisely tells the story of the disaster. Carved on the headstone is the following, a victim of the Lusitania, foully murdered by Germany, May 7th, 1915.
Whoa.
So that's pretty powerful.
He did eventually go to the front lines in France, right?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Talk to me about those dispatches.
Well, as he, on two occasions, he actually took part in raiding parties. And both of those stories are in the book. One of the Kansas City units was the 140th Infantry. And one night he went on a raid with them, and it's a pretty harrowing experience what happens. They come under fire. They all get back safely, but it is a very harrowing experience. Later on, he also goes, accompanies a raid made by the 117th Field Signal Battalion, which is also from Kansas City, similar, but not quite as harrowing, but very, very dangerous. And as he describes what happens there, you know, the shells bursting and jumping over the men to get back to the trenches. I mean, you get a – and then thinking as he's doing this about his kids at home and the family and what they're doing at this time, he looked at his watch and he knew how many hours.
And that makes it into the dispatches.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, that is an interesting piece of this. We just have a little time left, but I want to talk about this. Even though he's writing from Europe, he's writing home. He's writing, these are essentially letters home to Kansas City,
yes,
and only Kansas City. And that's not the kind of international journalism we consume today. Do you get a feel for Kansas City at the time and its relationship to what was happening in Europe from the way he talks to his readers?
Absolutely. As what I said earlier about this being a local war, I think is very, very true. He makes a lot of references to places in Kansas City. And as I was doing the research on the book, I researched those things, you know, the places and some of the people that people in town would have known. And one of the points that I tried to make was I assembled all of these writings by the date of composition, not the date of publication. And I did that on purpose because I really wanted to develop a sense myself.
His story.
Yes. How did he become aware of his own writing and how did that change over time? And it seems to me that it became increasingly more personal as time went on. And he was talking about Kansas City more and more as time went on. So, yeah, significant.
Our time is up. Jim Hyman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jim's book is Frontlines to Headlines, The World War I Dispatches of Otto P. Higgins. You can hear him talking about the book this Friday at 2 at the Midwest Genealogy Center in Independence. That's a wrap for today. You can catch all three of this morning's conversations later on at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we archive all our past shows, and you can sign up to have them sent right to you like a podcast on your phone or other device. Tomorrow, they announce the date when Hamilton tickets go on sale in Kansas City. That's a big deal for some people. We're going to talk about Hamilton mania and the insanity of the third-party ticket economy tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rao, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.